Welcome to Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle. Coming up on the programme this week.
It was 2 weeks after her 16th birthday that it happened. It shattered us into pieces.
When you think back to that time, does it still bring questions? Or have you decided on answers, settled on answers?
When she was 13, 14, she actually came to me and said, "Mum, I need your help because I have to let you know I've been suicidal my whole life."
And I'll be reminding you how you can make connections with mental health organisations within your community. It's Mental Health Monday.
The home of the UK's conversation about mental health. Welcome back to Mental Health Monday. It's great to have you with us. I've been away for a couple of weeks, had a little bit of a summer break, had some time away with the family. It was really nice, first time. We went camping together as a family, a couple of days in a tent, rained a lot in Derbyshire, but we had a great time. That was okay. Then we went over to Norfolk and had a week staying just southwest of Norwich, but in the middle of, well, absolutely nowhere, apart from the fact that there was a zoo on the doorstep. So yeah, lovely part of the world. Great break and great to be back. Great to be back with another episode of the podcast as well, and great conversations. You'll be aware episode 300 is coming around very quickly. I've got a project which I'm lining up to fall in line with World Suicide Prevention Day, World Mental Health Day, from the 10th of September through to the 10th of October, which I will tell you a little bit about as we get a little bit closer to the time. But you'll hear a reference to it in this conversation today. As I always try and do, it's about normalising the conversations around suicide. And the way we're going to introduce that, and the hopefully way we can relate that to people who maybe don't know about suicide, haven't thought about suicide, are scared to talk about suicide, are scared to think about suicide, is we're going to do it hopefully in a relatable way. And the way we're going to try and hopefully do it is do it from the perspective of parents who've lost a child to suicide. Might not be a young child, might be an adult child, but a range of different people who can tell that story from a parental point of view, so that even if people have struggled to engage with the story around suicide in the past, then hopefully a relatability factor around hearing from other parents will be something which will allow them to step into that conversation and open the door to that conversation. Now, I'm going to call that project Leave a Light On. The reason I'm going to use that language is that hopefully it's language that as a parent you would understand. You leave a light on for your kids when it's a bit dark, when they're going to bed, you know, the bathroom light stays on, the hall and stairs landing stays on. Later, when they start to go out for the first time, you leave the hall landing on so they can get their keys in the door when they step in and don't trip over the front mat and wake up everybody when they're coming in from a pub or a club at 2 a.m. Hopefully using that sort of language will encourage people to say, yeah, well, actually, yeah, I can understand what we're trying to do. I can understand the conversation. And of course, you can also leave a light on for hope. You can leave a light on for a friend. You can leave a light on for a family member. You can leave a light on when even that other person cannot see the light. And hopefully this sort of language will allow this particular project that I'm going to be working on to really open up the conversation about suicide. Today's guest, she's actually based in Kenya, which is really interesting. And there's a link to Kenya, actually, as part of a fundraising drive that she's doing very soon. But we're going to be hearing from Janetta Barry. Now, Janetta lost her 16-year-old daughter. She just turned 16, Jenny, to suicide. She wants to talk about her experience. And she says she's an open book to what she went through 18 years ago, but what she's done in the 18 years since, how she's developed, how she's gone through that grief and mourning period to hopefully try and find a new way forward to help other people. She talks about the impact of losing someone to suicide in that early period of time, the impact it has on immediate family, the impact it has on those relationships you have with other people who are very close to you, even within the family itself. She even speaks about spreading ashes of her daughter and how she has to use that as a moment to think, right now, something good has to come from this terrible, terrible situation. There is a website that Janetta now runs. It's called the Epiphany Process. I'll put a link to that in the podcast notes. There is also a fundraising event, which is getting underway pretty much as we speak, in Kenya, which is a Kilimanjaro challenge. And involved in that, you've got Paralympian Karen Dark, among others, who are doing a cycling event around sort of the base of Kilimanjaro. And then some of them are actually then going to go up Kilimanjaro as well. They're raising the money for World Jenny's Day, also held on October the 10th, the same day as World Mental Health Day, and the Kilimanjaro Challenge is about raising money to support the activity for that day. So there's plenty in this conversation. It was a pleasure to spend some time with Janetta. She started off by talking about why she wants to talk about what she's experienced.
It actually started about a month after Jenny died, and my second son, Neil, and I were spreading her ashes over the reef south of Mombasa Island in Kenya. And as I was trying to let go of that last handful, going, this is the last part of Jenny that belongs still to me and I can't let go. And as I let go of it, I went, something really meaningful has to come out of this. That, I mean, a senseless loss, really. And I knew that something big would come from this. I was determined something would come from it. But having said that, I had to walk an incredibly difficult walk, which entailed me never wanting to talk about it to anybody and shutting down and three times trying to or contemplating to end my life. So it was no easy path that I went on with this. And it took what I call my crossing over moment to realize that it was time to change it. And it was a series of happenings over the years. And in fact, the very first time I wrote about it was with a Hollywood script writer. And it took me 3 weeks of walking the streets of where I was living before I could even start typing, and he was coaching me. It was such a painful experience. And it was being released in a book with other pretty well-known people. And here's my story of the mother that did fail after an argument with her 16-year-old. That argument motivated her to end her life. And I remember when it came to the day to send the final copy off to be published, and having my finger over the send button and going, I can't do this. It's too painful and everybody's going to judge me. And what mother can go out there so publicly and go, I failed, even though the story talked about the inadvertent gift and what had happened. And what happened was, the moment I hit that send button and it went out there, quite the opposite happened. Suddenly people related to my vulnerability and related to my loss and were inspired that I could step forward and talk about this. And it really, even from then, was a process. There were times over the years where I felt cautious about things, and I've come, you know, it's 18 years this year since she left. I've come to that point where I'm an absolute open book, because I know the more we talk about this from a place of love, the more it's going to help people on a really deep level.
Can you tell me about Jenny?
Oh, Jenny was a really interesting character. She was the third of four children. She was the much wanted daughter after two sons. So we found out she was a girl before she was born, and we were doing flick-flacks and everything was pink. It was like, wow, this is the little girl and that's it. We're not going to have any more. And then we had this very special surprise that arrived after Jenny with my other daughter. But she really, out of all four children, was the most planned, celebrated, lauded child. And it was so interesting because the moment they put her in my arms, she was this squirmy, uncomfortable baby and always challenged me every step of the way. And, you know, what would work in terms of handling discipline would work one time and then would fail miserably the next time. There was no set way of holding and dealing with Jenny. She was this beautiful child. I mean, people, as she came towards becoming a teenager, and I mean, the picture we use for World Jenny's Day, she's only 12 in that picture, and she looks much, much older. So people would stop and say, are you that famous film star, or are you? Because she had this presence and this look about her that was just amazing. And that was her outside look, this smile on her face. I mean, in that picture, she was in a modeling competition, and that was the shoot after the modeling competition. And she just learned that one of her fellow models of the same age had killed herself the week before. She was in a terrible, terrible space in that picture. So Jenny had, she was multifaceted. When she wasn't in a place of feeling filled with neurosis, that nobody loved her, understood her, that life was too overwhelming, she was an amazingly insightful, knowledgeable person. I would stop and go, "Wow, Jenny, where did you get that knowledge from?" And she'd go, "I don't know, I just know it." She wise beyond her years. So she was a contradiction every which way, right until the very end.
You mentioned there that there was sort of the challenges even as a baby. She was like a challenging to hold. Was there a diagnosis at the time, or do you understand there was a diagnosis around her her behaviors, or why she maybe displayed some of those characteristics? Yeah.
You know, I was one of those mothers that tried to avoid labels. Maybe I avoided them a little bit too much. I just went, she's the one with issues and difficulties, and we'll see her through. But in hindsight, after Jenny did leave us, I have often wondered if she didn't have a bit of Asperger's in her.
Because, of course, as a parent, you're just dealing with the child in the moment, aren't you? You're not trying to view, you know, a condition, or you're dealing with a child with the getting them to school or getting to the after school clubs or responding to something else which is going on in the world. And that's sort of the normality of parenthood, isn't it, during that time?
And I came from an upbringing where an acting up child was just a naughty child. So it was really quite difficult, and especially with my parents around, who went, "Well, you're just clearly not being forceful and having the parameters enough." But the behavior of it, an example would be, we were living in a country that had drive-in cinemas, you know, where you drive your car in and watch on the big screen. And she accidentally spilt hot coffee all down the front of her. And she was about 4 or 5 years old. And I whipped off her pajamas to stop the burning. And she was screaming. So I was thinking, "Where's the pain, Jenny?" And we were trying to find something cool to put on it. And after about 10 minutes of her sobbing and screaming, we realized she wasn't worried about being burnt. She was worried about exposing her nipples to everybody in the car. 4 or 5 years old. So it wasn't, dealing with her was never reasonable in our value system. Things would just leave me flummoxed, going, "Oh my word, that's so interesting."
As she got into sort of those teenage years, was it easier just to dismiss some of those things as being, "Oh, here we go, this is the teenage, you know, this is what we expect from teenagers, there's that element of acting up, you know, pushing the boundaries"? Was there that element to it, do you think, in terms of her behavior?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because at the age of 8, she was acting out like a teenager. And I remember the housekeeper we had at the time turning to me, ironically saying to me, "If Jenny's like this at 8, what are we going to deal with when she's 16? And when she was 13, 14, she actually came to me and said, "Mum, I need your help, because I have to let you know, I've been suicidal my whole life." And at the age of 7, I even tried to strangle myself in front of the mirror, because I just don't want to be here, but the other part of me is scared. So can you help me get through this? So her teenager years were spent trying to help Jenny get through this. And it became very clear that part of her did and part of her didn't. She was quite focused on leaving.
That must be such a difficult thing to hear as a parent.
When she first said it to me, I was going, "What? what are you talking about, Jenny? Are you sure? You know, you start wondering if this is the fad, or is she copying somebody else, or enjoying making up a story? You go there as a parent going, what is that really about? And it took me some time, a couple of really botched times in rehab for her, for me to realize that really was where she felt genuinely. And she'd stepped into an eating disorder, she stepped into bulimia, and she blatantly would regularly say, I'm in this eating disorder because I made a choice to be in it, because it's the only thing that I can control that nobody else can do anything about.
It must be so hard to hear. But actually that element of eating disorders and control feeds into that wider conversation, doesn't it, about where people who are trying to find their way in the world try and sometimes feel like they have got to pigeonhole themselves to try and get a sense of maybe their own identity. And she certainly sounds, from what you're saying, that she was, you know, incredibly intelligent and gifted and aware of that surrounding as well. It must have been such a difficult time when you lost her, presumably raised a million and one questions, looking for a million and one different answers. Can I ask you, when you think back to that time, does it still bring questions, or have you decided on answers, settled on answers around what was happening in those final days, weeks, months?
In the early days, I was lost. I was a real lost soul, overwhelmed. As I mentioned previously, I started planning my own suicide because it felt like I'd stepped into this emotional deep black hole, like a lifetime emotional prison sentence. And the thought of feeling like this for the next 50 years, 40 years was like, I can't do that. And so it felt I didn't want to leave, but to just get past that pain, it seemed like a solution. And that's when I stopped and went, oh God, Jenny, I get what it was you were feeling. Because I was lost before she left. I was going, I just don't understand what I'm dealing with. So it gave me the answer of where Jenny was when she left. And 9 months after Jenny died, I was walking along a street absolutely mindless, going, ah, what am I doing here? And I knew I needed to cross the road, and I stepped off the pavement into the road, not really paying attention, not wanting to be hit, but not caring if I was. And I got halfway across and miraculously didn't get hit. And at the point I got halfway across, I had this revelation. It was not a voice inside me, but it was definitely me talking to me, going, Janetta, you've forgotten you still have choice. You've given yourself the label of the mother who lost her 16-year-old after an argument, and you've made that the thing that defines you for forever. And as a mother, there's a lot of complicated grief when a parent loses a child in easier circumstances, but definitely in the circumstances I was dealing with, what loving mother goes, I can move past that label and live the rest of my life. Does that mean I didn't love her? I didn't care? She wasn't lovable enough? What does that make me as a mother? But I got this really strong sense of it's time to move past this repetitive cycle of that's who you are. And I carried on mindlessly across the road and stepped onto the pavement the other side, and realized in that moment that I had a prophetic crossing over moment. And I call it my crossing over moment. And in that moment, I knew that I would do anything and everything to start studying and researching, because I had tried many modalities to try and get through it, to find an accurate way to move on and live a life and become inspired because of what had happened. And it took me a long time to walk the walk and study and research. And then with time, I've now been able to help people internationally online for about 15 years. Terrorist attack victims, kids who are self-harming and in bed and not eating and washing and writing suicide notes. They're living an inspired life on purpose. They're living their life purpose. You name it, I've helped them because I've walked the walk. I haven't read it out of a textbook. And that is where it's been a journey and a process. And I can honestly say I'm sitting in this space now where every morning I wake up and go, thank you, Jenny. Thank you. It doesn't mean I still don't have cycles of where something like, wow. Earlier this week, I have a TV show which highlights what's happening that week for the upcoming World Jenny's Day. And we do the preview video, which shows some of her videos of her. And the one suddenly just caught me and I went, oh. And there was a little bit of a feeling of tearing up. So, whoa, I haven't felt that for a long time. That happens. It's a lifetime process, this loss. But what I've been able to do is bring it into mostly open-hearted manageability. And because it is secular, understanding when those times do come up, they're part of the process. And I thank them. And I go, okay, there you are. There's a reason. It keeps my heart into what it's all about rather than just being theoretical. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I imagine that if anyone else saw that road, that street, they would look at it and think nothing of it, think nothing of the street or anything in particular. And then, but for you, within that moment, you've taken us on that journey. We know it takes 5-10 seconds maximum to cross a street, but actually to have that moment within there to almost give yourself permission to go through that change and then to frame it within that crossing the road. I think that's a really powerful thing you've done there, Jeanette. And it's amazing how sometimes the universe sort of throws those things at us. I think it allows us, doesn't it, to sort of get our heads around what we've gone through. Can actually, you touched on that before, and I've noticed that when I was reading about your story, there's been mention of this argument, and many of the conversations that I've had around people lost to suicide is that sometimes people think about what happened, you know, in the moments before, as opposed to thinking what was happening in the year before and the months before. But obviously, is there a sense that argument was a significant argument, or was it something that in particular that maybe brought to the fore maybe some of the issues that had gone before? Is there a reason you think that argument still feels like it's part of the story?
Definitely. There are many reasons. It wasn't the first argument. Obviously, mothers and daughters can get into quite a spat in other circumstances that are very part of being a mother and a teenager. That argument was because she was very intent on leaving the planet. So we had spent 2 years as a family tiptoeing around Jenny as though we were treading on eggshells. So, you know, rather like we were talking about an eating disorder gives you power. That's where Jenny became powerful, was that she knew that she could break just about any rule and everybody would say, okay, Jenny, that's fine. You know, how are you feeling and what can we do? And she was breaking all the safekeeping house rules. And it wasn't just affecting Jenny, it was affecting us as a family. You know, she had a baby sister 4 years younger than she, and it's confusing for a 12-year-old to deal with, and not safe for her, for Jen. And not really safe for us either. So, you know, eventually I'd hinted on it before and it had escalated into a spat, but not a huge argument. And I went, it has to end. And I've got to do it from my heart. And I wrote her a letter that morning and I scrawled it and woke her up with this scrawled letter and a smoothie and said, Jenny, this is non-negotiable. It really is. It is how we have to move forward. And so after having come back from homeschooling, because she bombed out of school, she was at a homeschooling group. She came to me and said, Mum, don't do this because it's not good. And I went, I'm sorry, Jenny, it has to go into that space and place. And that's when it escalated. And I didn't have the skills and tools that I have now to be able to deal with that type of conversation. And it did. And her last words were, it was 2 weeks after her 16th birthday that it happened. And her last words were, she was leaving home and packing. And her last words to me were like, whoa, basically saying, you fucked up my life and you fucked up my friendships. So those were her last words to me. And about 15 minutes after, I sensed something wasn't right. And I went to her room and she was dead in her shower in her ensuite bathroom. So, you know, the sense of all of that, if I look at the big picture, she's helped us all as a family inadvertently to start approaching how we communicate to each other from the heart rather than from judgment and fear or extreme judgment and fear. She's definitely helped us to communicate more. She's brought more empathy out on all we've done. And so there's so much attached to that conversation that has a long list of really uggies that I could sit here reciting to you because it is awful. But there's an equally as long list of where that happening and that argument has created a difference for so many for so long now that its absence, that would all be missing.
And thank you for being so open and honest about that. It must be very difficult to sort of think back to that time. One of the emphases is around our Leave the Light On campaign is about when it feels as dark as that, that there is, that we've got to find a way through those moments and we've got to empower each other to look through those moments with either an individual or with a support group as well. You talked about, you know, you're learning lessons. I think it's so powerful that actually you feel like in some ways that something positive has come from it, or that you've taken a positive from it as well. There'll be so many people who've been in your situation and will think, well, this is only a negative, but you obviously feel now with the conversations that you have, as you say, with people around the world, there's a skill set that you're able to offer. They say, well, have you thought of having a conversation like this? Have you thought about maybe bringing the conversation round to this? And that must be huge in terms of helping other people who maybe were in a similar situation to yours that felt like they couldn't get through that door, that felt like they didn't have that skill set to break through and have that conversation, the conversation that maybe they felt they needed to have.
Exactly. And it's the conversation the majority of us are missing. And that's why I know in being able, well, people who come to me, whether it's parents who've lost children to suicide or have challenged children and they don't know what to do with, or the children themselves and the teenagers themselves are at a loss. That's the thing, is that they can see I can see the light. They can feel I can feel the light, and they want a piece of that. They because if I've done it, then they know they can do it. It's a bit like Roger Bannister's mile, you know, until he'd done it, nobody could do it. And that's where I believe I sit, not for everybody, but for the people who are attracted to what I have been able to do with this. They know that there is a solution, they just haven't found it yet, and that there is a process and they haven't processed it yet, but that I'm the example and the actual instrument that can get them there. Because that's how I see I am. I'm the instrument. In fact, one of the wonderful things about working with these people, and they tease me once they leave me, is they say to me, you know, Janetta, one of the problems with you and your process is you keep on losing clients. And it's true, because I'm not their guru that they have to follow around for the rest of their lives. They powerfully go away with these tools and can do it for themselves. And that applies to people who've been through the most dire of circumstances. And yeah, and it's because I've walked the walk and I have the light there now.
I'll put a link, by the way, to the epiphanyprocess.com website on the podcast notes so people can find out some more information about the work that you're doing. Can I ask as well about the, obviously, your journey there that we're talking about? You mentioned the brothers and sisters, the family, the immediate impact of losing Jenny. At the time, what was that like? What was that experience like, seeing that impact on the family?
Yeah, it shattered us into pieces, and each of the children dealt with it differently. And just being able to let them deal with it the best they can, and not go, listen, you have to go on my journey the way I'm doing it. Just allowing them and allowing us to shatter. It's only in recent years that we've been able to more comfortably get together as a family unit. My husband and I already had a challenged marriage at the time that Jenny died, and that finished it. So we got divorced. And one thing I haven't mentioned is that my youngest daughter, we were living at that time in a country that allowed a 12-year-old to decide which parent to go and live with. And she was spitting mad towards me after Jenny died. And she chose to go and live with her dad. And that meant I returned to Kenya with a 12-year-old not with me, not living with me. And I call that my living death. That in some ways was more difficult than losing Jenny, because the conversations with Jenny were over. The antagonistic, challenging conversations were over. But having to deal with that loss, wow, it was tough, tough, tough. So I was dealing with the loss of a marriage, a loss of two children, and then also at the same time, I'd been trying to work with empty nest syndrome with my two boys who'd left home. It was a really tough, tough call.
And do you think that was the direct link to your own suicidal thoughts?
Yes, definitely. I was going, what have I got to live for? Nobody needs me. We go into that. It feels like martyrdom, but it is a very real feeling whilst you're going. Other people will see it as martyrdom, but I was going, nobody needs me. The boys are gone and they're living their lives, and Catherine's decided that her dad's the better being. So what am I doing here? And of course, that's the very blinkered view we go into in that moment. Understandably, there's nothing wrong with it. And it feels so real, and it feels like the truth, but it's only half a reality. And when we can see that there are two halves to that reality, when you bring them together powerfully, you get what is the actuality. And once I got the actuality, I could see a bigger picture of where my kids still need me. I can never stop being their mother. I was able to say, I'll always be my other daughter's mother. Nobody else can replace that. And to have me there and for me to move through this is what they're needing.
Can I ask you about, you got the Kilimanjaro challenge, which is coming up. You're going to have to tell me about this. You've got the Kilimanjaro challenge coming up mid-August, and then we're into World Jenny's Day, the 10th of October as well. Just tell us about that Kilimanjaro challenge, because that's quite the challenge.
It is quite the challenge, and it's the second year we're running it. So what's happening is people are gathering at the base of Kilimanjaro, near the base of Kilimanjaro, on the Kenyan side of Kilimanjaro, because some of our listeners today won't realize that Kilimanjaro is right on the border of Tanzania and Kenya. And so we're starting on the Kenyan side, and over 6 days, cycling from there through Tsavo West National Park, past all the wild animals, and through to Tsavo East. And then we're getting to a place called Wutamu Beach on the north coast of Kenya, north of Mombasa Island. Beautiful powder, talcum powder white sand beach. Staying at different lodges and camps that are just wonderful. Wonderful, wonderful. I did it last year. And Yeah, it's all part of the fundraiser for World Jenny's Day, 10th of October. And this year, we've got one of World Jenny's Day's ambassadors, who is British gold Paralympian Karen Dark, joining us. And she has been behind us now for 2 years. She's just such an amazing soul, what she's done. And she's just done in December a special trike made for her, because she's paralyzed from under her arms down, and crossed the Antarctic with a film crew. She's the first human being to cycle the Antarctic, let alone cycle it as a paraplegic. So she's joining us, and I'm so looking forward to it, because she and I are roomies. We're going to share a room, and we've got so much. It's the first time we're meeting. So she's joining us with a film crew, the same film crew that did the Antarctic filming. And they're cycling with us too. And then we've got Kim Chown, who's another one that's been through an amazingly difficult life and has written a book called Who Will Believe You? Just dreadful sexual child abuse and alcoholism that resulted from it. And she's come through shining that light. She's joining us with her husband. And we've got just some amazing people. I've got clients from Australia with autistic children. And so that's that side. And then Karen and some other physically diversified friends are going through to the Tanzanian side, and summiting Mount Kilimanjaro from Tanzania. And Karen is using that special bike she used for Antarctica to cycle up Mount Kilimanjaro. And the film crew's catching that as well. And then they're making a film to raise more funds for us that will be flighted early next year in London, Manchester and Edinburgh.
Really look forward to seeing some more about that and the work you're doing around World Jenny's Day as well. Jennifer, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. Appreciate your openness and your honesty as well. And thank you for joining us on the program.
Oh, Mick, thank you. It was an honor and a pleasure.
I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Thanks for checking out Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle. You can find me on Twitter at Mr. Mick Coyle. You can also find me, Mick Coyle, on Facebook as well. Don't forget, if you want to speak to somebody about your mental health, you can do so. The Samaritans, free to call on 116 123. You can find mental health services where you are. Just look for the Hub of Hope. Type in your postcode. It'll find those mental health services close to you. And for support in a crisis, you can text SHOUT to 85258. That's if you're experiencing a personal crisis, you're unable to cope and need support. Shout to 85258. That's a text line. Do get involved in those services. In an absolute emergency, always remember the number to call is 999. Thanks for downloading the podcast this week. We'll be back next week with more Mental Health Monday.